You are listening to The Link, an interactive podcast hosted by public policy experts at the U.S. Oncology Network. Your link to the policy that matters most.
Hello, and welcome to this edition of our podcast, The Link, linking community oncology physicians to the public policy world. My name is Ben Jones, Vice President of Government Relations and Public Policy for the U.S. Oncology Network. And here with me today is Angela Storseth, Director of State Government Relations, and our special guest, Dr. Leyland Wilfong.
This is just going to be a casual conversation about the policies of cancer care, and even more importantly, trying to connect the dots between the near constant political rhetoric and provider impact that it has on all of our network practices.
Yes. Thanks, Angela. So there's a lot going on. First of all, Dr. Wilfong, thank you for joining us. We are very excited to have you on the podcast. And it's timely because one thing that we wanted to talk about today was what practices are thinking as OCM sunsets and EOM starts to come together, still in the early stages. It's clear to everyone, I think, that CMS and CMMI are still focused on advancing value-based care. So maybe we can just kick off with your initial thoughts on the closing out, the sunsetting of OCM, and how you think we're positioned for success in EOM.
Yeah, great question. I think with the oncology care model, it was a true transformative model for the U.S. Oncology Network, which we embraced as a network wholeheartedly. And it completely changed the way we think about cancer care and moving it much more patient-centric and thinking about a whole person cancer care and how do we provide the best value to our patients. And it's led to significant success in the oncology care model. I mean, we recently released our last results, which showed a record amount of performance-based payments. We had over $30 million in performance-based payment as a network, which is unremarkable. And that is the money that we saved Medicare in the program. And our quality scores continue to be top-notch. I mean, our practices are taking really good care of patients and saving Medicare significant money and being rewarded for that. It's led to significant change in how we look at our contracting with other payers. Many other payers are looking at the high cost of oncology care. In fact, the Public Business Group on Health just recently released a statement saying that for employers in the U.S., cancer care is now their most expensive diagnosis that they use, that they have for their employees. For decades, it was musculoskeletal care, and now it's cancer. And so there's a spotlight on cancer care and the cost of cancer care. And being in part of the oncology care model has led us to be the leaders in this space and be able to contract appropriately with our payers around value and aligning that payment that we do and getting paid and rewarded for taking really good care of our patients at a good value. Plus, it's also leading to some steerage opportunities with payers where we are now seen as the leader in value-based care and people are coming to us saying, we're struggling with the cost of our care. Please help us. We want our employees, our patients to come to you as a network rather than going to other high-cost centers. So a big transition. I was worried when the oncology care model ended because I was afraid it was going to stop that initiative. We've been able to bridge that somewhat with our commercial contracts. But I was excited when we heard about the enhancing oncology model as the continuation of OCM. And we'll get into and talk about some of the challenges and benefits of that model. But I'm excited about having another model because as the largest payer that we have for most of our practices with Medicare, having a model that really pushes us into value is good because it aligns with everything else that we're trying to do as a network to position ourselves in the best place possible.
You know, it's interesting. You mentioned some of the significant cost savings that we had in the OCM. Collectively over the life of the program, we've really saved Medicare a lot of money.
$250 million.
That is a lot of money. But unfortunately, when you hear some folks in the public policy circles talk about the program overall, it's almost a mixed bag. So how do we convey the message of our success to the decision makers at CMMI? I know you're in regular contact with them. Is it resonating with them how we've been successful and how we can kind of be a driver going into EOM?
I think the folks at CMMI recognize our success. They know that we, as a network, dove in headfirst into the model and did what we needed to do to make the changes to make us successful. And that's positioned us well with them. We do have their ear. They listen to what we have to say. They understand our needs. And if you look at OCM as a global model, it was not successful. And I firmly believe that's because a lot of practices out there didn't do what we did and make the necessary changes to succeed. But it puts us in a really good position moving forward as the leaders in this space. Now, that being said, I mean, government's government, and there's a lot of rules and regulations and policies they have to follow, which is irritating to me. But I think we're in a good position to be the leaders in the space.
I resemble that remark. No, but it's interesting. I mean, you're right. Sometimes government is an obstacle, but there certainly is this overwhelming momentum to continue to explore value-based care. And we really have been a leader, thanks to your leadership, not only in your new role, but talk to us about how it was on the other side of the coin. When you were a physician, you're still a physician, obviously, but when you were a practicing physician in the OCM, looking at it from that side, can you talk to us about that perspective as well?
Yeah, you know, 2016, Russ Hoverman, who's my mentor, came to me and said, hey, would you like to do a little quality work for Texas Oncology? And I thought, oh, yeah, that sounds like fun. And then a month later, he said, there's this little bitty program called the Oncology Care Model. Can you lead it? I'm like, okay. And then here we are, 6 years later to where we are today. But that being said, I think it was a challenge. It was a challenge to take us from a traditional fee-for-service platform to a value-based care world. It took a lot of work to make sure that we were aligned on our initiatives. Drug contracting was a big area that we had to spend a significant amount of time figuring out how do we align utilizing lower cost therapies and value-based therapies for patients with our strategy, our overall financial strategy of a practice. So we spent a lot of time looking at that. We spent a lot of time looking at the additional resources we needed to hire to improve the care that we provided. And are we adequately getting funded from OCM and other models in order to justify those resources? And we came out very successfully on the back end. I mean, Texas Oncology in particular has done significantly well in the model, but it took a lot of time and effort and debate and analysis to get to where we are today.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, we're so glad that you did have that background and to be able to lead this, because you've done an incredible job working with our team too on the government side. So what do you think are some of the, or can you talk to our listeners about the key differences between the new model and the previous model?
So the Enhancing Oncology model, which the new model is slated to start July of 2023, one of the biggest differences is the decreased number of patients. So it's focusing on only 7 high-risk cancers versus the oncology care model, which is pretty much any patient with cancer who was on any therapy for cancer. This is focusing on that a subset of really high-risk patients. And if you look at the oncology care model, for the low-risk patients, those women on hormone-only or men with prostate cancer on hormone-only, or bladder cancer on intravesicular therapy only, those patients, we did not do well in the model. And this was not just our network, but across the country. And that's because they're really low-risk cancers that we don't actively manage as much of that patient's care. A lot of their care and cost are truly their other medical conditions that their primary care physician should be managing. So one of the benefits of EOM is that we're focusing now on 7 high-risk cancers, where these are the patients we are actively managing as oncologists. You know, they are the ones that are under chemotherapy and treatment that is toxic, that we must manage, that we need to be seeing those patients regularly. We need to be taking care of those patients. We really take ownership of that patient journey when they have these cancers. So I do like that approach, that we're focusing on the cancers that are truly under our control. Another one of the biggest differences is that it's a risk-bearing model up front. So practices coming into the model have to bear risk up front, whereas the oncology care model had a glide path to risk. We had a period of time where we could choose not to take risk before we had to take risk. With EOM, you have to take risk from the get-go. So it's a little challenging for practices to be able to step into a model that we may not know fully how we're going to perform and say, I'm willing to take risk. And if I don't perform well, I'm going to have to pay the government back money. That's a really hard thing to do. But as of right now, the model has us taking risk from the get-go. And I would say the other thing that from a quality standpoint that's different in this model is that we are supposed to focus on health-related social needs, which is a good thing in a way that we need to think through that. It's a challenge from an operational and funding standpoint of how do we actually take that on? But that's going to be a focus. And then there's going to be a focus on electronic patient reported outcomes, which, Ethan Bosch published and some other people have published too, a survival benefit for EPROs. So it's something we should be doing, but then the struggle with that is operationalizing it and getting it into the clinics. That's a big lift. And so there's some good and potentially good, but challenges with the EOM. There's some other changes as well that we don't necessarily will go into, but those are the big ones.
So it's interesting because when I first started to look at the model, read through everything, I had some of these takeaways like, okay, smaller subset of patients, immediate risk, a requirement to do more, whether it's through EPROs or monitoring and recording social determinants of health, all while they are going to cut MEOs mm-hmm. by more than half. So talk to me about how you think the program, with all of that, what's going to make it successful?
It's a good question. I forgot to mention the MEOs is cut a little more than half from $160 to $70 per patient, $100 for dual eligibles, dual eligible being patients who are on Medicare and Medicaid. So there is less money to do practice transformation. On the flip side of that, though, in a risk model, the less money that we're accountable for, the better it is to obtain a PBP. So if your total cost of care is cut down because you're spending less money, which they include the MEOS payments into our benchmarks, you have a better opportunity to obtain a performance-based payment. So on one hand, you don't have as much money coming in to fund transformation, but yet on the other hand, you're not as accountable for those additional costs. So I go back and forth for that of, do I want more money to fund my transformation, or do I appreciate not having as much money so that I can get more of a performance-based payment? And honestly, I think that's going to relate a lot to where practices are. Practices that in the oncology care model that funded transformation activities and have an infrastructure in place will be able to succeed on the $70 MEOs per month. I say succeed. I mean, there's still some challenges with implementing EPROs and some things that are going to require outlays of cash for practices to be able to do. But I think those who have experience in this will be okay. I worry about the practices who haven't gone the transformation route. Is $70 per patient per month enough for them to fund transformation activities? Because it's a year to 2 years before you actually get a performance-based payment in the model. So we're going to have to do that analysis for our practices that we're not involved in the oncology care model and really understand how much it's going to cost for them to participate if they haven't done any of this work already.
So you touched on something there at the end that I hope doesn't sound like a loaded question, but you're exactly right. So much of this is going to be on a practice-based analysis. Talk to me about how important analytics are going into this model.
Huge. Analytics are huge. For our practices that were involved in the oncology care model where we have baseline analytics, our analytics team has done a tremendous job using those and able to model how our practices will be predicted to perform in the EOM. It's not perfect. We don't have all the variables in there correct yet because some of them, CMMI hasn't released yet. Some of it requires us to, things we don't know, like what are national and regional benchmarks that are changed a little bit in EOM versus OCM. But on the whole, our analytics team has done a great job helping practices understand predicted performance in the EOM for those that were in OCM where we have data. For those that were not involved in the OCM, it's challenging. We don't know exactly how they're going to perform because we don't know what their benchmarks are, what their expenditure adjuster is. Those are things that we can't calculate. We can work with them to think through predictors of performance, things like biosimilar adoption, therapeutic substitutions, the care navigation activities that they have to undertake. We can measure those things and give them ideas of where they are relative to our practices that we knew did well in OCM and those drivers of success. But it's more challenging because we won't be able to do full analytics for them at this point.
Well, Dr. Wolfong, this is something that we ask all of our guests that attend our podcast. But while this is a very important issue, we're sure that there are tons of other issues that keep you up at night. So our question is, what keeps you up at night?
I think what keeps me up at night from a government standpoint are the non-value-based care things. And I'll give you some examples. The waste modifier that's coming from CMS, where for single dose vials, we have to refund waste. I guess it does relate to EOM. How does that translate into EOM performance? Because that was one of the drivers we did of performance was dose rounding and dose banding. We saved 1% to 2% of total cost of care with those initiatives over practices that did not do those things. I'm not sure how that waste adjustment is going to factor in, for example, and we need clarity on that. I think Part D reform is another big one that keeps me up at night. And, you know, with plans responsibility going from, was it 15 to 20% now in the catastrophic phase to now 60%, what are plans going to do to combat that increased cost? Because, you know, they're not going to just say, oh, we're going to pay it, right? There are going to be things that they're going to do. And I worry about the effect on our patients with cancer, inability to access medications affordable medications for orals. And as it relates to value-based care, how does that translate into our ability to succeed in value-based care models? That keeps me up at night a lot. We've had a lot of conversations about that change in that reform. And then just what's going to happen in the future? I mean, I think, you know, my goodness, policy. Who's going to control the House? Who's going to control the Senate? In two more years, who's going to be our president? What are crazy things are they going to try to do? Are we going to actually do anything? I think those are big challenges too. And thank God we have you guys to help us navigate those challenges on the Hill.
It is, it's an interesting time in Washington, I'll tell you that. And in states across the country, because a lot of the same conversations are happening at the state level. But yeah, I don't know. It's, you know, we've got a couple of months before the election. Maybe we can pivot away from EOM just a little bit, if it's okay with you guys. And let's throw out some predictions. You know, one thing that we typically have a segment in our podcast called In Case You Missed It. And that's when we highlight something that is meaningful, news breaking, but maybe didn't make like the front page or the headlines. There's been a lot that has been floating around lately that didn't make the front page that I think is meaningful. And one of them is really this shift in some of the polls, where if you asked anyone, any of the political prognosticators 2 months ago, they would have said the Republicans are taking the House, they're going to take the Senate, and a lot of the polls are tightening. Most think that the House is probably still likely to flip, but the Senate is truly a toss-up. So here we are, less than 2 months away from the election. Is that right? What do you think happens?
I think, and I'm an educated guess on this, but I think that Republicans take the House by a very slim margin. And I think the Senate stays with the Democrats.
I'm routinely told not to make predictions, but I always do anyway. I think you're right. I think the House flips. I think it's probably not as wide of a flip as they would have thought 2 or 3 months ago. But I think they probably still have a double-digit majority next January. The Senate is a little bit more difficult to predict. But if the election were held today, even with 5 or 6 toss-up seats, I would imagine that a lot of the last-minute tie-breaking votes come in, breaking towards folks that have the economy as the central issue that they're voting for, which probably bodes well for the Republicans. But these races are tight, and they're tight in states where I didn't think they would be tight. But to the second part of your answer, a lot of it really just predicates what's going to happen in 2024 with the presidential. And I think that's what all eyes are going to be on. If there are any major announcements by any major candidates that potentially could be somewhat divisive or controversial, if any of those announcements are made right before the election, I think it could change things. And if it doesn't, we should be watching very closely what happens right after the election. Maybe we can just kind of bring it back to EOM. And Leyland, can you, if there was somebody that's trying to learn about EOM, what advice would you give them right now, going into kind of the timeline when they have to at least apply, a little bit of runway between full implementation or entering into an agreement? What would your advice be for those practices?
My advice is to apply for the model. The application deadline is September 30th, so it's coming up very soon. If you don't apply, you're out. Right? You actually have no choice if you don't apply. Applications are non-binding, so definitely apply. And then over the next 6 months or so, we should have a lot more information about the EOM, do much more of a deep dive in the analytics, understand the complexities of the model better. Historically, what's happened, CMMI, during this period of time, will release more specifics about the model as they get feedback and understanding of it. So definitely apply. We will have many educational sessions on the EOM for folks if you're interested. We have an in-person workshop for leadership scheduled for the beginning of February. And then before applications are due, our team will do significant deep dives with each practice so that we have a very good understanding of predictive performance on a practice level and what things need to happen for practices to be able to succeed so they can make a much more informed decision about whether or not they should actually sign the application. And then if you have questions, just reach out. Reach out to me or anybody on my team, and we will help you with whatever you need.
Awesome. Thank you very much. And I hope you'll join us again as we continue to learn more about EOM. Join us again for some of that. And you also opened the door to Part D reform and what that means or what that might trigger with some PBMs. I think that should be a podcast episode all in itself, because there has been some aggressive moves made in that space that, if we're not careful, really will undermine access to quality cancer care. So, okay, thank you very much. It's hard to believe that we're already at time, but really appreciate you joining us today. Hopefully you can join us again in the future. And thank you for listening in, and we look forward to seeing you on our next podcast. Have a good day.
Thank you for listening to the LINC podcast, your link to the legislature. For more information on healthcare policy and the U.S. Oncology Network, visit www.legislink.com.